Football Weekly Extra. On today's show, the midweek action. As friendly but bereft of real meaning as Barry's morning greeting, or conclusive proof that England, Spain, Argentina and Brazil are all about to win the World Cup. We look back on the action from Berlin to Brasilia as we attempt to decide. And we look forward to the following. The debut of Paulo Sousa at QPR, Villa, Man United, Valencia, Sevilla, Inter, Juventus, Ashley and Rio's film with Fidi, Arsenal, Man City and Catania dropping their trousers. All that and more in Football Weekly Extra. Hello there. On board today, almost literally drooling with anticipation, Barry Glendenning.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. John Ashdown.
Hello.
A very composed Paul Doyle.
Hello.
And it's a big welcome back to Amy Lawrence.
Hello.
Hi, Amy. You've been away so long that you've slipped a disc, had a kid, and
forgotten also, everything I ever knew about football.
Really? And yet you still know more than I ever will. Now, hands up, who watched England's midweek game with Germany? Ooh, that's not bad. I'm not going to reveal the number of people who watched it, but a significant proportion of the pod. So, okay, who's going to start us off? Amy, do you want to start us off? Significance. Two C teams going at it, one of them won. Does it mean anything?
Well, the only thing that occurred to me was the John Terry Carson spectacular. Had that happened a year or so ago, I think it's almost certain England would have gone on to lose, or fairly probable England would have gone on to draw. And the fact that England went on to win does suggest a sea change, really, in the mentality that Capello has introduced. And the other thing that occurred to me is, obviously, it was all very exciting to see the C team do so well, as you described them. But when Italy won the last World Cup in 2006, Lippi used all but two of his squad in the tournament. He used them importantly. They didn't just come on like a Peter Crouch for 10 seconds to run around. The only two players who didn't play in that World Cup series was the two reserve goalkeepers. So, obviously, if you actually want to win a World Cup, I think it helps if you've got more than 11 decent players who know what they're doing. So the fact that England appear to have a first 11 that sort of know a lot more what they're doing anyway under Capello is great. The fact that he also appears to actually have a bunch of second-string players who look very capable of coming in and being the part does give a bit more credibility to the fact that England, okay, great, look like they're going to actually qualify for this competition, but perhaps are going to be better equipped to go a little further than normal.
As you say, there does seem to be a big change in mentality as well. Sean Ingle, who sadly is not with us today, was very keen on pointing out that a year ago we were having that big chat about how abject England were under Steve McClaren and how his team would have coped with a fixture like yesterday and the kind of error that Terry and Scott Carson combined to make. Why is Scott Carson continuing to get England call-ups and caps? He's doing dismally for his club. He doesn't do very well for his country.
That's grossly unfair.
Well, the last couple of weeks he's made some horrible...
Had a bad day at the weekend.
Had a rubbish game against Liverpool. He had another bad game at the weekend.
If you look at the...
It wasn't his fault last night, though. It was Terry's fault, surely.
Whose fault was it?
It was Terry's fault. I've just said it. Terry had the ball.
Right.
All he had to do was kick it. I mean, Carson isn't going to come over and tackle him to get it off.
But he still sees Carson rushing towards him.
I don't think Carson wasn't rushing.
He was wondering what the hell is Terry doing.
What was he doing out there, though? What was he ambling towards the ball, just sort of randomly? There's a ball. Must walk towards it.
Well, it depends. If Carson called for the ball, he should have come for it. If he didn't call for the ball, then it was Terry's responsibility to get rid of it. So Carson claims he didn't call for it, which makes it Terry's fault. But I do think England have a problem at goalkeeper. They need a goalkeeper they can rely on, and they don't have one.
Mm.
And until they get one, they're not going to be contenders, really, for a big tournament.
Well, they're only not contenders in the fact that they do concede goals. And if you look at the recent run of results, the only clean sheet has been, I think, against Andorra. Mm. And even then, actually, the Andorras were a little bit unlucky, I think, once. But that is the key, that they still make these kind of very frail defensive mistakes, and I don't know whether Capello is capable of actually bringing a bit of Italian style defending over into this England team, but I think while England are playing with this enthusiasm, they're probably quite confident that they can outscore the opposition most of the time.
Certainly was another significant marker, wasn't it, the fact that a first win in Berlin for 35 years, Paul, although as you correctly point out, how many games Germany have played in Berlin, given the political situation over the last three or four decades?
Yeah, I don't know. Mm. It's also worth pointing out that Terry almost got James in trouble in the first half as well with a slack back pass. So that, I'm sure that contributed to Carson's confusion when he was coming towards the box wondering what Terry was going to do.
Who is the England goalkeeping coach?
Ray Clements.
Is it right?
Which is a better answer than Harry Redknapp could give last weekend when he was asked who Tottenham's goalkeeping coach was. And he said, Austrian lad.
He found out, he found out soon enough, didn't he? Because he sacked him during the week.
Quite precisely.
Excellent. Now, Barry, you weren't able to enjoy the spectacle in Berlin.
Sadly, no.
You were busy doing minute by minute on Scotland-Argentina.
That's correct, yes. Diego Maradona's tenure as Argentina manager got off to a winning start.
Mm.
He didn't go ballistic on the sideline. He sat quietly in the second row of the dugout for most of the game, came down to issue instructions a couple of times. Argentina tore Scotland apart in the opening 10 minutes, scored after 7, brilliant goal by Maxi Rodriguez, which was set up by Carlos Tevez. And after that, they kind of took their foot off the gas. But it was a very competitive match. There was some meaty tackles going in. Scotland were outclassed throughout, but, you know, we'll probably learn from the match.
What do you think, what lesson would they draw from it?
The lesson they would draw is that Chris Commons was excellent for Scotland on the left wing, and certainly, I would imagine he would come in as a fixture from now on. They will learn that they have a lot to do to qualify for the World Cup, which they probably knew already. But a team like Scotland is never going to be able to compete on level terms with a team as good as Argentina.
Mm.
But they need to organise themselves a bit better. Argentina's defence wasn't brilliant either. They did let... There's a couple of occasions... Scotland
they let the Scots have a shot, apparently. One shot.
Two shots. I think was Chris Commons... Well, Chris Commons' shot slash cross almost snuck in at the near post. And there were one or two other shots as well. But then at the end of the game, Maradona gave all his players a big hug and a kiss on the
it
cheek.
It was quite homoerotic, didn't you think? There was a real loving going on there.
It was slightly.
That's definitely the Maradona effect.
But even on the way to the ground in the bus, they had a drummer on the bus, and Maradona was leading the sort of acting as cheerleader, motivating the team. So, yeah, he did quite well, and Terry Butcher didn't appear to shake his hand. So it was his big chance to prove he's not a complete tosser, and he blew it.
Right. Barry Glendening's views do not necessarily reflect those of the pod. However, I hear where you're coming from. And a very small crowd turned out. They're not short fans, but I mean, they weren't in numbers. They weren't...
There were 32,000 at it out of a capacity of 55,000. So I think Scotland, the Scottish FA, had notions of filling the stadium for this fixture. But Scottish people are renowned for their thrift.
Yes,
and with the credit crunch or whatever, it being a school night and it being a friendly, they obviously, you know, 32,000 is not a bad crowd for a
Wednesday
night.
They did jack
night.
Up the prices, though, didn't they, in order to pay Argentina's fee?
Well, they had to pay 800,000 to get for Argentina to play the match, and I think 30,000 would have seen them break even. So, but the ticket prices were, I think, 25 quid, which isn't too bad.
I thought the point was they didn't break even on the thing, but there you go. Certainly wasn't a resounding success in terms of the attendance. Also not having resounding success is Ireland, who saw Trapattoni's unbeaten run end with a 3-2 defeat at home to Poland.
Yeah, well, they were at home to Poland, but apparently most of the crowd was actually Polish because there's a massive community of Polish people in Ireland, so they all went along to see their team. Trapattoni said he was happy with performance afterwards, and again, it's a friendly, what can you take from it? But Glenn Whelan and Darren Gibson got a run out in midfield again. They got another game under the belts, which is nice because they never get picked for their clubs, so it's nice that they're at least playing for their country. Of course, the big elephants in the corner of the room were Andy Reid, who, the way some people in Ireland are going on, you'd think was Pele, you know, that because he's been left out. I mean, he should probably be on the bench, but he's not that huge a loss. Well, huge physically, yes, he is anyway, etc.
Well, I haven't seen it. I did record it, but I haven't seen it because I was doing the England game. But I'm told, admittedly, by some drunken friends of mine who were in a rage after the game, that Trapattoni set out ultra defensively and still conceded 3 goals. So that's not a good sign,
Especially in a friendly as well.
Yeah. What is a good sign, though, is that our main rivals for second spot in the group. Bulgaria conceded six goals.
Right, tell us about that game, Paul.
They lost 6-1 in Serbia, and Serbia also missed two penalties. But the big story in Bulgaria, as another drunken friend of mine, this time a Bulgarian, rang to tell me this morning, Berbatov walked off the pitch after 30 minutes.
He was drunk this morning
minutes.
When he rang you up?
Drunk with rage at least, and certainly slurring his words. Berbatov walked off the pitch, trudged off. He's been criticised for the last few months in Bulgaria for his perceived lack of effort when playing for the national team. And he trudged off the pitch, signalling that he wanted to be substituted and leaving the manager with little choice but to do that. Afterwards, the manager said he had a slight injury, but the commentator on Bulgarian TV went into a rant against Berbatov, saying, well, who cares, he won't be missed, he doesn't try anyway when he's on the pitch, etc. And Berbatov's agent rang the TV station and said, OK, if it's going to be like that, how about if my client retires from international football? How would you like that? Now there's a big standoff. And we're not sure whether Berbatov has retired from international football or not. It'll be interesting to see whether he's fit enough to play for United at the weekend.
Well, indeed so. Northern Ireland lost 2-0 at home to Hungary. Zoltán Gera with the second Hungarian goal. We think the Welsh got a win in Denmark. Craig Bellamy scoring his first goal in 14 months internationally, and apparently Aaron Ramsey did well. So well done to the Welsh. I'm guessing that nobody here actually saw that game.
I saw the first 20 minutes because it kicked off before England. So
right, okay.
I watched a little bit, and it's hard to tell. You can't really take a great deal out of it. But if you look through the Wales team, they have got a fair smattering of proper good young players.
And very young side, no?
Yeah, absolutely. And the sort of, in order for them to qualify for major tournaments, they're going to have to go to places like Denmark and win. And so I think for them, it's quite a significant result. I mean, obviously, I don't think it was a full-strength Danish team. It's a cracking result for John Toshack and his boys.
Well, the Danes apparently later on were booed off by the home fans of Denmark currently.
Well, you would be, wouldn't you, losing at home to Wales?
Well, fair enough.
Nigel Worthington went off on a big rant about after the Northern Ireland game and said he was very embarrassed at the poor performance and suggested that some of his players weren't fit because they're not playing for their clubs. David Healy, I'd imagine he was talking about there, among others. So he was not a happy bunny at all.
Hmm. France-Uruguay, you were mentioning that man Savidon.
It was Savidon, yeah.
And he came on. And
he came on at half-time and apparently was the star of the show, although he didn't score. It was a nil-nil draw. But
right.
Apparently he looked very lively and sharp up front and teed up a few chances for his teammates, which they fluffed.
We're nil-nil with Uruguay and apparently boos for that man Dominic. The subject of Savidan becoming a footballer late in life after a stint cleaning up bins, and that prompted a flurry of activity on the post. A blue tyke says he's trying to think of a precedent. So it's a bit like Ian Wright. He says, I think Jan Koller was a construction worker prior to turning pro. I'm not sure if anyone can confirm or deny that. Viva Luzita Suarez says, wasn't Stuart Pearce on the buildings or an electrician or something?
He was an electrician when he started playing for Nottingham Forest. And while playing for Nottingham Forest, he continued working as an electrician and used to put ads in the Nottingham Forest matchday programmes advertising his services as an electrician. Presumably he can still wire a house if that under-21's job doesn't work out for him.
Well, always good to have a backup plan. As somebody, and I'm sorry, I don't know who it was, mentioned Dario Hubner, Tatanka, the bison, who was regularly top scorer despite smoking like a chimney, and B, I think fitting windows. I think he fitted windows until about the age of 24. Although probably the classic example in Italy would be Moreno Torricelli. I don't know if we remember him. Kind of Jesus-like figure with long hair and long straggly beard, who was basically a factory worker who played part-time for a team called US Caratesi. He was a factory worker. He worked as a carpenter in a kind of wood kind of workshop place until the age of 22, when said US Caratesi played a pre-season friendly with Juve to give him a bit of a run-around. And Torricelli impressed Trapattoni so much that he got signed up for a trial with Juve, became a regular starter with Juve, went on to join the Italian national team, played for Italy, was part of their squad for both Euro 96 and the World Cup 1998. So, pretty extraordinary career arc there, Amy.
Well, Argentina Maradona's new assistant, Carlos Bilardo, was, I think, a gynecologist while he was either playing or in his early days of coaching. And at the same time as doing both those things, also ran his parents' furniture business, which sounds like an extraordinary trio of things to do at the same time.
It's not that amazing that these guys, you know, had proper jobs. I mean, in Ireland, you've hurlers and Gaelic footballers who are probably as fit as Premiership footballers. And they hold down day jobs while training at night and playing at the weekends. So, have you ever had a proper job, Jimbo?
And on the subject of footballers having employment outside, you know, the confines of their club, you'll have seen perhaps this story about Rio Ferdinand and Ashley Cole moving into the world of movie making. Have you seen this?
No, I heard it in your introduction and was suitably bewildered.
They are exec producing a film called Dead Man Running, and have just signed up Curtis Jackson, a.k.a. Fiddy Cent, who will be joining an all-star cast, which includes Brenda Bledin, Monet Mazur, I'm not sure, and Danny Dyer, all about an ex-con who's got 24 hours to pay Jackson's loan shark $100,000 or become a, here come the inverted commas, dead man running. Not sure who the director is. It's got Ken Loach written all over it, though, wouldn't you say? Anyway, and the exciting thing is that Ashley Cole and Rio Ferdinand are exec producing.
Does that just mean they're putting in the money?
Fronting cash, I think so.
It sounds like they're onto a winner. If it's even half as entertaining as Rio's World Cup wind-ups, we're in for a real treat.
Magnificent stuff. Anyway, we'll have a little bit more international chat on the subject of Brazil and their huge win over Portugal in a second or two when we dial up Fernando Duarte, also still to come, Sid, and the many delights that the weekend holds in store.
Football Weekly Extra with James Richardson.
Now, joining us on the line is Fernando Duarte, who's eager to tell us, as indeed only he can be, about Brazil's massive 6-2 victory over Portugal. Does the word victory, does that encapsulate it for you, Fernando?
Yeah, it was a great, great game for Brazil, to be honest. I mean, we saw everything we wanted to see. It's like Brazil actually moving the ball around, actually showing some talent. Of course, it's easier when you play against a side like Portugal who actually goes for the game as well. Mm. Had they just sat behind, you know, or parked the bus in front of the goal like Mourinho used to say, etc., it would have been difficult. And it has been proved that Brazil struggles against this kind of opposition. But yesterday, they came from the game, scored first at 4 minutes, but then, you know, Brazil just took over. Brazil were on another level yesterday. Kaká had a massive game. Fabiano scored a hat-trick. Even Maicon scored an amazing goal, like the ones he usually scores for Inter Milan. A proper Carlos Alberto 1970 World Cup movement thing, with the ball being knocked around, and then Robinho, I think, laying the ball for him. And he thumped an amazing shot past the poor keeper, Kin. Elano scored a screamer as well. It was a very, very good game.
Yeah, they also haven't scored any goals in a year at home. So Dunga was the subject of much booing and whistling, I believe, when he came out at the start of the game. Does this take a lot of the pressure off him?
I think it takes a bit. But again, it's a friendly. You know, you shouldn't take friendlies as normal matches, etc. Of course, Brazil, in my opinion, in a good position in the qualifiers. It was the last game of the year. You know, in February, play Italy. So it takes the pressure a bit away. But then when he come back, his first game is against the current world champion. So, you know, that's football. But yesterday was great. A bit of a note, Cristiano Ronaldo was awful yesterday and was picking fights. You know, and the funny thing is that his image of Marcelo from Real Madrid, the left back, actually squaring up to him, and the guy's half his size. He wasn't very good. He got injured trying to tackle Elano. It was a bit of an abysmal game by Portugal. And I was reading the Portuguese papers this morning. Everybody's pissed off. They didn't like the routing, of course, but they also pissed off with Queiroz's tactics. And, you know, the people are already asking for his head today, especially the guys leaving like posts in the blogs, etc.
All right. Fernando, the fact that it is Portugal, the former colonial power and all that, does it make the victory all the more special, or do people not really bother about that anymore?
Yes. Yes, it does. Of course, we hold no massive grudges, but it is always philosophical, you know, to kick the backsides of our former colonial powers. Of course, we have a very good relationship and general sense, oh, yeah, we are united by the language, by our common past, etc. But now, I mean, when Scolari was there, I hope they were successful, etc. But it's always good. I felt a bit, an extra bit of doses of happiness yesterday, you know, to see them being, like, routed. By the way, it was the first time in 53 years that Portugal conceded more than, or conceded six goals.
Magnificent. Thank you very much, Fernando, for telling us all about that. We'll speak to you soon.
Okay, my man. Take care.
Thanks, Fernando.
Cheers, bye.
Next up for Brazil are Italy, as Fernando mentioned there, at the Emirates in February. Italy had a 1-1 draw with Greece, not really worth talking about, except that Luca Toni scored an actual goal in it. So there you go. Not sure what he was trying to do at the time, probably make a clearance or something, I'm not sure. But anyway, there you go. Italy, plenty to talk about in Italy. And one of our posters, True Faith, complaining about the fact that in our last show, amid our massacre...
What, you mean one of our posters has been complaining?
Well, he makes the point that amid our flurry of puns over the Mascara hat-trick last weekend, we missed out on the real news in Catania's defeat at Torino, which was the new Catania free-kick technique, which involves a double wall. Yes.
I saw this, yeah.
You saw this, yeah? Well, four Catania players basically go beyond the first... They set up the proper wall, and then another four players go on between that wall and the goalkeeper, where they're clearly standing in an offside position. Once they get there, one of them, a bloke called Plasmati, who's almost 2 metres tall, drops his trousers... And basically drops his shorts to the Torino goalkeeper. And then before the kick is taken, they run back onside, join the wall. But crucially, he keeps his shorts down. And this has been the subject of much tactical analysis in Italy, where they feel that it's not about wiggling your bum at the goalkeeper. It's actually the fact that, you know, a tall man with long shorts keeping his shorts down effectively impairs the kind of visual... obstructs the view of the keeper.
Well, considering Catania's manager is a goalkeeper, yes, and will have obviously instructed him to do this, Zenga will know that being a keeper,
yes,
the view through other people's legs is quite important.
Very important. And Mascara duly scored. It was the second of his goals.
Will this start a trend where bringing on props?
There's no law against it, which is
on a cape or something.
But didn't some Italian FA officials say it was a disgrace and a crime against decency and it shouldn't be allowed?
Pierluigi Collina.
Oh, really?
The man from the Micon himself. He did indeed. He is now the Keith Hackett, if you will, of the Italian refereeing world. He's in charge of all that sort of thing. And he spoke up this week saying that he thought it was a disgrace. There isn't actually anything against it legally, but or rules-wise, because that was another big debate on the post this week.
Flashing is legal in Italy.
Well, there's nothing to stop you lowering or displacing your clothing to aid your performance.
Is it not ungentlemanly conduct?
Well, I think it is, but they don't have that concept necessarily.
Come on, if you can get a yellow card for taking your shirt off.
Well, he didn't take his shorts off, he just lowered them a bit. Apparently, according to Collina, who I figure knows the rule, but he says there isn't anything there yet, but he'd like to change the rules to do so, and he feels that it is... completely against all the, you know, the sporting principles of football. Plasmati says no, that he wasn't intending to be disruptive or anything.
Well, I remember
what was he intending to do?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly. However, you know, I think there's been a certain amount of amused respect for Catania's nous on this one, or noose, or whatever you call it, tactical ingenuity. And the Gazette is certainly referencing one or two other cute tactical innovations of late. In fact, just this March, I don't know if you remember this one, the Roma-Milan game where Roma unveiled a new free-kick technique, which they'd used in training to some effect, but it didn't actually pay off this time. It was Pizarro goes over as if to take the corner, gently taps the ball so that nobody in the stadium can see, and then walks away as if he's just been told that he's not going to take the kick, somebody else is going. Rodrigo Tadei comes up, and whilst everyone else is waiting for him to take the kick, he just suddenly starts dribbling it towards the goal. And everyone's like, well, you can't do that. But the kick has already been taken, so he's perfectly legal.
And did the referee realise the kick had already been taken?
Do you know, I have a feeling the referee didn't realise that, called it back. But the linesman, then had an argument about it, because the linesman had actually said,
ball has to do a full rotation in order for it to be legal.
It doesn't sound anywhere near as good as that famous penalty with Thierry Henry and Robert Pirès.
Tell us about the famous penalty. Was this
on, James.
Is this the Cruyff, was it a redux?
Well, it was supposed to be where Robert Pirès just gently taps the ball from and Henry arrives very quickly and smashes it in. And they tried it against Manchester City, I think, with a score at 1-0.
Right.
And Robert Pirès didn't kick the ball hard enough. And it barely moved, and Henry didn't think that he'd actually kicked it. So they both stood there over the ball, and then Manchester Somebody City cleared defenders it. Arrived, right. understandably, to get rid of the thing, and the two Frenchmen looked like buffoons.
Right, just imagine if they'd lowered their shorts, how much better.
Sadly.
It's only a matter of time before Sepp Blatter calls for this Catania thing to be introduced to women's football, isn't
Absolutely.
It? Boost Absolutely. Boost the popularity.
Yeah, but you know, it's this degree of tactical innovation which has got Mourinho so excited about his time in Serie A. There's been a lot of talk about whether Mourinho might conceivably be jumping ship because he's looked a bit miserable, picking fights with people, not turning up for press conferences, that kind of thing, shaving his head, other, you know, indications of a troubled psyche. But anyway, and people are talking about Man City. And but I don't know. He does seem to genuinely love the kind of the tactical challenge. And he was saying that this week that you know, Serie A, nobody likes it abroad. He said, "I'm one of you." He says, "But nobody likes Serie A abroad. For me, it's great. I have this game against Genoa. I had to change formation four different times in that game. Every time the Genoa manager Gasperini managed to respond, and so we had a stalemate. Eventually, we win it right at the death. For me, that is a perfect match. But you know, spectacle-wise, it's a zero." We have Inter and Juventus, who may well have something of the same this weekend. Big game. I won't go on about it, Barry. But Inter-Juventus.
Go on about
weekend.
It if you want. Do you think? I get the impression you think it's going to be a real damn squib.
No, I did say to Paolo that I didn't think it'd be very good. But Inter, I don't think they encourage flair from the opposition, as Mourinho teams rarely do. The kind of line in Italy is that Juventus have the teamwork, and Inter though have the team in the sense that they have the skill in their players, the skillful players rather. But Juve, when you see the way they've come into this team on seven straight wins, Alessandro Del Piero on fire, and despite this huge injury crisis, all the players that got out, Buffon, Trezeguet, Cristiano Zanetti, etc. I think they are actually good shouts to win that game at the San Siro, which would put them level with Inter on top. Let's speak to Sid Lowe in Spain, who's got all the latest on the Liga. Sid Lowe in Spain. How are you doing, Sid?
I'm not too bad, James. How are you?
Excellent. I'm very well. We're looking forward to hearing about the weekend's excitements in the Liga. I know that Spain had a win over Chile midweek. We don't probably want to hear too much about that, do we? Anything that we need to know about that?
Well, not really. I mean, it was just Spain playing very, very well again. It's now 28 games unbeaten, 25 wins and 3 draws in the last 28 games. 6 out of 6 under Del Bosque, 16 goals scored, 1 against. And they were brilliant again. I suppose from an English point of view, the interesting point is that Xavi Alonso is very much back in the side under Del Bosque. Of course, he was mostly a sub with Luis Aragonés. Del Bosque really likes him, and he was brilliant again last night.
Magnificent stuff. Now, in the Liga this weekend, Sid, we're starting to hit those run of really important fixtures that could have a large bearing on the title race this year. This weekend's one being Valencia-Sevilla. Tell us why this is significant, Sid.
Well, mainly because this is the first step towards a run of games when Sevilla, Valencia, Villarreal, Barcelona and Real Madrid all play each other. Because of the way the league has set up the fixture list this year, every team follows a run of four games, which is starting with Sevilla, then you play Barcelona, then you play Real Madrid, then you play Villarreal. Now, what happened is, of course, because those teams can't play against each other, that run breaks down during this small period. They've stuck in the gap, as it were, because obviously Madrid can't play Madrid and Barca can't play Barcelona, is Valencia. So that means we have a five-week period when they all play each other. The only side you could say is even remotely a league title candidate that's not involved, this is Atletico Madrid. And of course, that's the reason why Atletico's coach, Javier Aguirre, is saying, hey, everyone says we're rubbish, but hang on, let's wait and see. Because if we keep winning over the next few weeks, this lot will inevitably take points off each other and we could climb back up the table. But it does look like we're basically going to have a five-week period now, another five-week period in April, where a big chunk of the league title will be decided.
All right, so now Valencia-Sevilla, what can we expect in that game? Who's most under pressure, Valencia?
Well, it's a strange one, this, because they're both under pressure in their own ways. I mean, they're both on the same number of points. They've both been beaten twice this season. They're both looking reasonably good in their own way. The problem is that Valencia have now lost the last two at home. They were beaten by Racing Santander and then by Sporting Gijón. And they look like they lack that little bit of creativity in the middle of the pitch. Sevilla under terrible pressure. And their coach, Manuel Jimenez, has had the fans on his back, those fans that... It's weird, the Seville fans, some of them believe they're not creative enough. others who remember him as a player, and he was, to quote one of his former teammates, a really dirty bastard. They really liked the fact that he kicked people up in the air. They, of course, sing that chant, Jimenez, Jimenez, que cojones tiene, which is, Jimenez, Jimenez, what balls you have, because basically he was a tough guy. And they like him for that, but there's a feeling that Sevilla are not creative enough. And so while they're getting results, they were getting results into the recent three-game run where they didn't win, they don't entirely convince. Although there's big news for them, and that's the fact that Luis Fabiano and Freddy Canute are both back.
Mm. And Fabiano in fantastic form for Brazil. Very good, Sid. Thank you very much indeed for that. Look forward to speaking to you on Monday. Have a terrific weekend.
Speak to you then. Cheers.
That was Sid Lowe in Spain, as I hardly need point out. A couple of posts here. Matt Goodison says, as someone who lives with Barry Glendinning, I can confirm that he always makes a point of shooting you down when he's right and covering up the evidence when he's wrong and you're right. He has even changed Wikipedia to prove he's right. Barry?
Well, for a start, that post wasn't written by Matt Goodison. It was written by one of Matt Goodison's friends pretending to be Matt Goodison. Matt Goodison.
Is that what Matt told you?
No, I know it for a fact. Matt Goodison was outraged when he saw that post. He's back in Melbourne now, having left the country.
Let's deal with the subject with the charge.
All right.
Yeah. Do you change Wikipedia to?
I've never changed Wikipedia. I wouldn't even know how to change Wikipedia.
Wasn't it you?
This all stems from an argument I was having with someone on the blog over whether there are. Football has rules or laws.
Yes.
I'm adamant that cricket is the only sport in the world that is governed by laws. But some people on the blog who are wrong suggest football has laws too. It doesn't. It has rules.
Right. Football most definitely has laws.
It doesn't.
What's the governing body of football?
Pardon?
FIFA, right?
Yes.
And FIFA have laws.
Which came first?
Only until
the rules of
Barry
football or
which
FIFA?
Came first? The fact is that FIFA have laws. Football has laws.
We have differing views on this one. I happen to agree with you, Barry. I happen to. There you go.
Thank you. That means I'm probably wrong.
Argyle says, spelled in an interesting fashion, that. Just to add to the Diego Armando Maradona Jr. info, thought you might be interested to know that he represented Italy in the Beach Soccer World Cup final this summer and even scored in said final when they lost 5-3 to Brazil. Very good.
Football Weekly Extra on guardian.co.uk.
John Ashton, you want to tell us a little bit about the Championship? QPR, some exciting news there. Paulo Sousa.
Yeah, I was all set to tell you about Paulo Sousa, and then I looked at my notes, which involved the name Paulo Sousa, and I looked at Baz's notes, and there's half a page of beautifully scripted floral handwriting, so maybe Baz can tell us about Paulo Sousa.
Who wrote that for you, Barry?
I wrote it.
All right, then. What do your floral notes say?
My floral notes say, that someone in QPR has said that he's going to be the new Jose Mourinho with all his flair, charm and talent.
Right.
But
they don't pronounce names very well there at QPR, do they? Go on, anyway.
But I don't know whether he is going to be the new Jose Mourinho or not.
Okay.
How he fares will depend on whether Flavio Briatore lets him pick a team or not, or whether Flavio Briatore picks the team for him, as has been suggested he did while Gareth Ainsworth.
Well, apparently Briatore wanted to keep Gareth Ainsworth in charge.
Well, obviously, because Gareth Ainsworth was apparently quite happy to have his team picked for him.
Well, no. Ainsworth always denied that. Briatore came in to give a motivational speech before the game, but Ainsworth decided on the team and tactics, according to Ainsworth.
Yeah, they discussed between the two of them. He wasn't dictated to what the team was. Yeah.
Does Ainsworth go back to being a player now, or what?
He's reserve team coach there.
Oh, okay.
So presumably he'll take that.
Still registered as
and
a player as well.
Play.
Right, they're in 10th place.
Yeah, I mean they're doing okay. It's the appointment that you knew Briatore was going to make, and it's the one that almost certainly makes the least sense for the Championship.
It's a wrong appointment, is it, John?
Yeah, it's tough. Well, if you look at the teams that are doing well in the Championship at the moment, Birmingham, Alex McLeish, Wolves have got Mick McCarthy, Reading, Steve Coppell. They're all people who know the lower leagues. And I suppose you could argue that QPR tried that tactic with the appointment of Dowie as somebody who knew how to get promotion into the Premiership. And it was, to a large extent, working. They were only a couple of points off the playoffs when he was let go. And he didn't leave for footballing reasons. He left because of this interference from Briatore. So it's hard to see. As long as he keeps picking the players, the four or five exotically named players that Briatore wants in their team, then I'm sure Briatore will be happy. Whether that will mean them shooting up the league or not, I'm skeptical of that fact.
He's their eighth manager in 2 years.
Wow.
You're never going to get promotion operating a policy like that. If they really want promotion, which they do, obviously, they should have just broke the bank to get Mick McCarthy from Wolves or someone. Someone who's proven ability to get side out of the Championship and into the Premiership.
I'm not sure they have the players to get promotion for a start.
All important questions. Amy, you've got an important appointment back down on Earth. So just before you, you know, dematerialise and that, do tell us about Man City and Arsenal. Because you have more than a passing acquaintance with the Gunners. Obviously, they've been the subject of much talk of late, both the positive and the negative. Which one of this Jekyll and Hyde-style football club are we going to see at Eastlands on Saturday?
The one you least expect. So I suppose everybody who's expecting Arsenal to go up there and get beat, they'll probably turn on the star. And anyone who thinks it might be a good day at the office, they'll probably be utterly insipid again. I don't suppose even Arsene Wenger knows, and that's really the...
I thought Arsene always knew. I thought that's the point of Arsene. He couldn't explain away, though, the Villa defeat, could he?
No.
That's worrying, isn't it?
Well, it's just... I think if you have the kind of squad that he has at his disposal, what Arsenal are doing this season is exactly normal. If you have a squad that lacks a bit of experience... with some technical players who, when they feel like it and are in the mood, can be, you know, electrifying, and when they're not up to it, are really dismal. You're going to fluctuate wildly from being rather good to being absolutely atrocious, and that's what Arsenal, you know, that's where they're at the moment. And I think it's important what Steve Sidwell said on the weekend was really telling. I think there was a time not that long ago when most teams would stand in the tunnel next to Arsenal and look over their shoulder and see Patrick Vieira, Tony Adams, Sol Campbell, David Seaman, even Jens Lehmann. Okay, he was mad, but he still had some status. You know, throughout the team, there were very, very big characters, even the ones that were not the superstars, like a player like Lauren, who was still really, really hard as nails and not someone that you would mess with. And Pires and Henry are wonderful, wonderful players who were also consistent. I think if you look over your shoulder now, you're just not seeing players who are at that level, either sort of psychologically or in terms of talent. So, of course, a team like Aston Villa or Man City or whoever think, okay, Stoke or Hull or whoever can fancy their chances on any given day.
I was just wondering, to what extent did David Dean, whose departure a couple of years ago seems to have marked a bit of a change between, you know, one Arsenal level of competitivity and the other, to what extent did he actually keep Arsene Wenger, you know, feet on the ground during the transfer
market? Well, I think what David Dean gave to Arsene Wenger is somebody to talk to about football on a level that he doesn't have anymore. I think he's got that total autonomy now at the club where even his assistants... Pat Rice is not someone who's going to say no to him ever. Bora Primorac, who's his old buddy from way back when, is a very soft, lovely guy who is not going to argue with him either. And I think he needs someone to turn around him and say, hey, Arsene, come on, you know, what about this or that or the other? Or maybe we should try this. And I think with David Dean, he had that kind of relationship. And he had someone that who was a doer who would go and do things as well as, you know, have a proper intellectual discussion about where the club was going.
Win or lose? Eastlands, Arsenal? completely impossible to predict, is it?
Absolutely.
All right, then. OK. Amy, you're going to Chelsea, Newcastle, but you say you don't want to talk about that.
No, I will if you want me to.
I don't want to think of it. I mean, and Nicolas Anelka scored 8 goals in 4 games. Newcastle haven't, etc., etc., etc. This one seems pretty straightforward to me, Barry, noted Newcastle fan.
Chelsea win. We've been getting stick for our... previews, weekend previews on the blog.
Right.
I'm not sure what the readers expect. We record on a Thursday. We don't have injury news. We don't have team news. You know, so all we can do really is mumble some half-arsed prediction about what might happen.
I don't know. That's true. I think Amy's just lit the way in quite admirable fashion with a rather more in-depth focus on the broader issues behind it.
I think Newcastle are a very poor side. They have many problems, all of which need to be solved and solved quickly.
Right.
With that in mind, I think Chelsea will rip them a new one.
Right. Okay. Aston Villa, Man United. Villa, the team that beat United. But they haven't beat United in the Premiership since August 1995, which is a very long time ago, John Ashton.
It's at least, 13 years, I think, It's one of those ones that you could say that maybe it will answer a few of the questions as to how much of a chance Villa have got of getting into
because they have the
four,
same disease that Arsenal have, don't they? Yeah. They're good and then bad and then good and then...
Yeah, and we'll have to see what injuries come off the back of international week as well. Which
right.
could play a big role in all these games.
Well, we didn't mention the fact that Walcott's out for is it
10 weeks?
Middlesbrough Bolton.
Well, that's a game that really gets the pulse racing, isn't it?
Portsmouth Hull.
Again.
Best league in the world.
Hull are fabulous at the moment.
They've had 1 point in their last four games.
But generally speaking,
in broad terms,
still worth watching.
Hull are continuing to mark their arrival as a Premier League force. Firstly, we had that set two in the casino at 4 a.m. And now their manager, Phil Brown, has been fined £1,000 or more about his future conduct as a result of kicking a water bottle in frustration while his team was being trounced by Wigan earlier in the season.
And he got £1,000 fine for kicking a water bottle?
Yes, well, I think the ref wanted to send him to the stands, but he trudged off before the ref had the opportunity to do so. He's been financially hammered instead.
One thing I heard about Phil Brown in the week was that he has a bit of facial hair, then it goes again.
Well, that was to raise money for testicular
cancer. Is it a Movember thing? Have you heard this Movember? Grow a moustache for November, and it's called Movember?
A couple of the Munster rugby players were wearing them on during the week, I saw, when they got beaten by the All Blacks. Some guys grow moustaches for charity for November.
Caution everyone, there's a punchline coming here.
No, there isn't.
Oh, right, okay.
No.
You were just staring at my facial hair as you said it. Some guys grow facial hair for some, etc. No, okay. Oh, there you go. Stoke West Brom, tell you what. They are in trouble, aren't they? And
it's a relegation six-pointer.
It is a six-pointer, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Sunderland are taking on West Ham, who are heading in the wrong direction themselves. Gianfranco Zola. Didn't take long for the smile to disappear from his chirpy Italian face, did it?
No, and it's a shame because his smile was one of the nicest things in football. But you have in the Premier League, there's 10 points between the team that's sixth, Hull, and West Brom in 20th. So a good result could send Sunderland rocketing up the table into the UEFA Cup places, maybe. Same for West Ham. They would they'd be up mid-table if they got a win. But it's too early to be worrying about relegation six-pointers yet.
Unless you're West Brom.
Well, or Spurs, or Blackburn, or Newcastle, or Wigan, or Stoke, or West Ham, or Bolton, or Man City.
Right, okay. Tottenham, meanwhile, are taking on Blackburn. And
that's a relegation six-pointer, Jimbo.
It certainly is. Yeah. Tell you what, that's the thing about the Premier League. They're all crucial matches. And then on Monday, Wigan-Everton. Amy, it looked like you were shaping up to interject something.
No, just when Barry was talking about leaping about the table, I think Fulham, a couple of weeks ago, won a game and moved up 9 places in one fell swoop. So it's just, it is too close for anybody to be in any kind of major trouble at the moment.
There's an interesting game in the Championship tomorrow night, if anybody's interested, which is Swansea against Birmingham. Which if Swansea win, they'll be up in the playoffs. And it's an interesting story because of obviously Roberto Martinez, the Swansea manager, who I don't know if anybody out there presumably they'll know him, but he was one of the three amigos that went to Wigan, one of the three Spanish players that went to Wigan in the mid-90s, having been brought up in the Real Zaragoza youth system. He's played almost his entire career as sort of a lower league journeyman. And so his sort of footballing philosophy is taken from Spain and the youth system there. But it's very much wedded to the realities of lower league football. And he's doing an absolutely fantastic job down at Swansea. And he is the exact sort of manager that QPR could do with. And if they win tomorrow night, then they'll be up in the playoffs, which would be excellent news.
Fantastic. Brilliant.
Jimbo's just thinking to himself, what is Swansea? what is this Championship you speak of?
It is a box of delights, isn't it, for football? Thanks, Barry, for that. That's sadly all we've got time for today. But we'll be making another voyage into a voyage of discovery into the wide world of football next Monday. And possibly you'll be along for that, will you?
I don't think I will, actually.
No, Barry. No. All right,
I'm off on Monday.
Oh, OK.
Can we get that sort of cheering or booing sound effect back
to you? Supply your own, listeners. Producer Pete, thank you. John Ashdown, Paul Doyle, Amy Lawrence. Hopefully you won't be a stranger this time. Lovely to have you back. And enjoy Chelsea Newcastle. And I hope you enjoy your weekend, listeners. See you on Monday.